So as I said, we're doing things a little bit differently this summer, artsy summer. Something a little fun, you know, I was thinking that between the kind of the public events, the current situation, and then the liturgical calendar with Easter and Lent and Pentecost, it have made it very difficult to not do sermons that have felt very urgent and topical and present tense to me. So it might be nice, I was thinking, to the summer to step back a little and think a little larger and less sort of in the today moment. So hopefully Artsy Summer will give us a chance to do a little bit of that. I do want to say one little word more about the covers of your bulletins, about the coloring book stained glass covers of your bulletins. I know that seems perhaps like a little bit of a childlike exercise, and in some ways it is a childlike exercise that I'm inviting you into, but I do want to invite you to think that maybe there could be something serious about it. I used to lead a discussion group at a homeless shelter for homeless teens, young men and women who'd been kicked out of their houses for having children, or for being gay or lesbian, or who ran away because they were being abused. And I would sit with them once a week and talk and just try to provide some space for listening and for sharing. And I found that it didn't go very well at first. I mean, I was not the ideal person to be sitting with them, for sure. And everything quickly often devolved into recrimination and yes and no and hurt and who hurt whom and who was the victim of which and right and wrong. And everyone was very easily distracted and very easily pulled away from what anything we were talking about was. And one week perhaps it was an inspiration or maybe just an accident, I brought a box of crayons and some copier paper and just set them on the table in the middle of the room. And instantly, I gave no instruction about what it was for or what was supposed to happen, but they all grabbed a piece and they all started drawing. And instead of being more disconnected or distracted, they were more engaged with the conversation. And the conversation changed a little. It was no longer about what them, they, over there did to me, but it was just about what's going on inside. And the conversations got deeper. And when I saw these things that they had drawn, they were so beautiful and so heartbreaking or hopeful or poignant, depending on which child, which youth was feeling what thing on which day. It was transforming for me, too. I don't know that I added much. It was one of those stone soup things. I just brought some paper and some crayons. And then they created something that, you know, was an offering to me and a blessing for me. So it's in that spirit that I offer you these coloring book stained glass windows. And if you want to grab a blank piece of paper and go outside the lines, or live in a world where there are no lines, you're welcome to. Please join me in prayer. Amen. So today I want to begin this time by trying to lay out a little bit of theology. It's a little ironic, I think, trying to get at art by talking about theology. What is that old saying that talking about music is like dancing about architecture? Well, I have no idea what theologizing about art would be like in that case. But just to lay a bit of a foundation, to think about why it is that art, even non-religious art, even just secular art, becomes such an important vehicle for God's Spirit in our lives. And where I want to start is exactly in that place where I say it's ironic that I try to do theology about art. Because art exactly is that thing that goes beyond theology. The point of art, the point of human creativity, is to reach beyond what we can know. Theology is about analysis, about description, For me, the whole point of thinking theologically is to say everything we can say about God, that we can say literally, that we can say this is what God is like. God is love and not hate. God is caring rather than indifference. God is involved rather than remote. But what do any of those things mean in the concrete? If I say to you, God is involved in your life rather than remote from your life, what will you say? What will I say to you when you say, well, what does that mean today? That's something that theology can't answer. Then we get to the place of the mystery, of the moment, the mystery of what is beyond analysis and description. Art shows what cannot be described. How do you give words, for example, to the depth of the love you feel for the person you've decided to spend your whole life with? What analysis can you provide of that? Or what description can you give to the complexity of those feelings, that strange mixture of adoration and resentment, of gratitude and loneliness that you might feel at any given moment in your related life together with another? How do you explain or theorize the grief of a departed friend? The sheer particularity of the anger you feel when you've been betrayed by someone in this way, by this person of whom you'd assumed these kinds of commitments. How do you describe the sheer particularity of the guilt you feel when you're the betrayer? Our words fail us when we try to describe the truest depths of life. That's why I like crayons and blank paper. I'm a terrible drawer. My drawings look awful. But sometimes even my drawings speak more eloquently about my life than any words I can put together. And in fact, I would say that if we want to make progress in the life of faith, if we want to make progress in the cause of justice, then where we have to start is exactly in that point of verbal failure. We have to get exactly to that point where experience reaches beyond words, where we no longer can analyze or explain what really matters, what's really going on. We need to go to that place, to seek out that place where we don't have a pat answer. We need to get to that place where all of our explanations fail us. That's where we begin. The place beyond our science, beyond our factual knowledge, where we can wrestle with the deeper questions of meaning and worth. Beyond the place of facts to the place of meanings, to that space of creativity that risks something new. We need to get to the place where we no longer know the right answer, and maybe there isn't one, the place of mystery, and begin our work there. Paul has a beautiful description of that moment when you've reached the place beyond your explanations. He says, we know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now, groaning in labor pains, giving birth to something, but we don't know what yet. And not only creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, we groan inwardly while we wait for adoption, for the redemption of our bodies, for in hope we were saved. And then he says this strange thing, now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, then we wait for it, and I want to say we work for it with patience. The world of mere fact is a world without hope. The sum total of the evidence of things as we see them reports only itself. But in God's Spirit, we find a yearning for more. We yearn not only for what is, but for what it means and what it might become. Within the fact, we begin to feel the possibility of its fulfillment. We feel images of alternative worlds that are closer to God's desire than the world we're currently in. That's what hope is. Born in the images we see of something more in our discernment of God's call to us. That's hope. Born in our imaginations inspired by God's imagination. That is the hope in which we are saved. And what about when our imaginations fail us, when we can't see a way forward? Paul has a suggestion for that too. He says, likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness, for we do not know how to pray as we ought. But that very Spirit intercedes for us with sighs too deep for words. God, who is perfect love, is also perfect imagination, a perfect possibility of seeing what more might come of the present moment. So when our wells are dry, the Spirit's fountain refreshes us. When we can't see another way, the Spirit can reveal one. In the divine Spirit, our imaginations are never dead. And even when we don't know how to pray, the Spirit intercedes for us with sighs too deep for words. Now, let me try to get us to the art part. Let me back up just a little bit. Paul talks about Spirit often in terms of flesh and spirit. And often it's hard to know just what Paul means by these words, flesh and spirit. Sometimes what Paul seems to mean is that flesh means sin, flesh means brokenness and fallenness, where spirit means faith and wholeness and salvation. Sometimes the way Paul talks about it is that spirit is good and flesh is bad, spirit is faith and flesh is sin. Spirit is the holiness of God in us, and flesh is the dirtiness of our humanity. And that leads, of course, to these ideas that our bodies are wicked, and that the entire natural world is somehow fallen and evil and dirty and if not exactly worthless, then just perilous and almost hopeless. And that leads to this belief that Christianity has often entertained, that the only good is this spiritualized otherworldliness, the denial of the body, the denial of the things of the flesh. But when that's what Paul means, I just think that's bad theology, right? That God created us all, flesh and spirit. God called us all good. So I think it has to be wrong to call the flesh bad. Paul sometimes offers a better vision, though, that the flesh, in some places, is just what is, the inert, the objectively true, what is either good or bad, what is either beautiful or ugly, the raw material of things, the raw stuff of life, capable of good or of evil. And in those places, Paul talks about the Spirit as what gives us life, what gives life life, what gives that flesh its possibility for faith and for virtue and for beauty, what connects us to God and to each other. I often think that's the version of Paul that read the Genesis story in Adam, where God forms Adam out of the dust of the ground. That's flesh, the dust of the ground, and then breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and Adam became a living being. I think that's the way we can understand flesh and spirit better. Flesh is the dirt of the ground, the things of this world. Flesh is the world of facts. Flesh comes to life, though, when spirit is breathed into it. Facts come alive when in God's imagination they're given meaning. That's why art is so important, I think. Art is what happens when we give meaning to fact. Art is what happens when we pour spirit into flesh. Art is what happens when we don't know what we ought to say in any straightforward way. We don't know how we ought to pray, but the Spirit intercedes for us with sighs too deep for words. Art is what happens when God forms dirt into the shape of Adam and breathes life into him, and he comes alive. Adam is God's greatest work of art. The Spirit is this wind that blows where we will, and we hear the sound of it, and it rushes into Adam, and he comes to life. That's the power of art, to take dead dirt and to make it breathe, to take the stuff of the flesh and to make it alive. As the quintet gathers to give us a far better example than I've been able to do this morning, I want to tell you one little story. I had a friend who was an oboe player. And he bought this fancy, you'll have to correct me if I get this wrong, but he bought this fancy French oboe, and they mailed it to him, and he started blowing wind into it, blowing air into it, and it cracked. And so he had to mail it back to France to get a new headpiece, and he worked on that one, and again, it cracked. And I said, well, what's going on here? And he says, well, that's just what oboes are like. That's part of the price of the purchase, is they keep mailing you new headpieces until you get one that doesn't crack. And it made me think about this sort of this dead piece of wood, this dead stick. And you look at these things, they're all just plumbing and tree parts that have been hollowed out and made fit for wind. And once the wind goes into them, they come alive. You blow air through them and they come to life. Like God breathing life into Adam, the first human, the wood, the metal come alive. And something new and different than we've heard before comes out. And like us, the wood itself maybe doesn't know how to pray, but the Spirit intercedes in it with sighs deeper than words. May we, like the wood, hear the sound of the wind rushing and come to give voice to something, to a meaning, to a possibility that we didn't know existed before. Amen.